Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, it is an absolute pleasure to introduce you and be joined on the Solari Report by C.J. Hopkins. C.J., thank you so much for your work and for joining us today. And as I said, I'm not going to introduce you. I want this first section to really be a discussion about your background in history, because I want everyone to know really how you evolved and arrived at this place. So first, welcome to the Solari Report, and thank you for your amazing, amazing work.
Thanks very much, Catherine, and thanks for having me on.
So I figured the reason you're so sort of, you have so much buoyancy and happiness is you went to college in Boca Raton.
No, actually, I went to college in Miami.
Oh, I thought University of Miami was in Boca Raton.
Oh, no, it's right in Coral Gables. Yeah, in the middle of
I'm sorry. Okay. And so you became a playwright coming out of university.
Yeah, not exactly. I left home, which was Miami. That's where I was born and grew up. And I left there in 1985 and moved all the way across the country to San Francisco. And at that point, I decided that I had gone to film school, but I didn't really want to try to get into the Hollywood business. And so I had decided that I was going to be a beat poet in San Francisco. Because, you know, I'd been reading a lot of Jack Kerouac and, you know, Ginsberg and what have you. And so I went out to San Francisco and dragged my then girlfriend out there and a friend of mine. And I wrote just a ton of really, really bad poetry. and had a few wonderful years out there right after college. It was before the dot-com boom. And then I met my now ex-wife, who kind of dragged me back into the theater. Bless her. I had been an actor in school and done a little professional acting in Miami during my college days. She was a theater director and dragged me back into the theater. I started writing experimental texts for the theater, which turned out better than my poetry. Soon enough, 1989, we decided we needed to move to New York City, being a couple of theater artists.
Now, if you look at the plays that you've written and have been performed, they've been performed all, it's mostly in the Commonwealth countries, but you've been performed in Scotland, in England, in Germany, in Canada, as well as New York. So you seem to have very quickly gone global.
It's funny. It actually wasn't so quickly. My longtime collaborator, the theater director, John Clancy, there's a joke that's running in 2002. We were at the Edinburgh Festival, the Fringe Festival, and that's kind of where I got lucky and broke through with, it was my first play. But it was written in 1992 is when I
did.
And so 10 years later, there we were at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and people were, you know, coming up to us and coming up to me and saying, you know, I can't believe that, you know, you wrote this so quickly after, you know, the 9/11 attacks in 2001 and what have you. And I didn't have the heart to tell them that, you know, that I had written it 10 years earlier. The joke was John's father came up to him and said, I forget, I'm going to blow it, of course. He said, you're a 10-year overnight success.
Well, but you clearly got onto, I'll use your terms, the global capitalist ruling elite early.
It's funny, you know, Catherine, just to finish the theater story, you know, many good years. I was in New York for 15 years and during the 90s, you know, did a lot of experimental theater. My plays were mostly produced off Broadway and what have you. And then we broke through in 2002 with Horse Country, which, as I said, I finished it in 1992. And I kind of wrote Horse Country during the period of time that the Soviet Union dissolved.
Right.
And that period of time, you know, it's I think all my work is kind of framed by that, because I feel like when the Soviet Union dissolved, we really entered into new territory that the world has never entered before.
Right.
That was global capitalism's last ideological adversary.
Right.
And it dissolved. And, you know, since then, we've been in a, you know, in one big global capitalist world. Yeah.
Right. Right. And it's funny, I feel almost remorseful, because if you look at the global capitalists, they don't believe in capitalism. They believe in monopoly. So it's a very unique kind of capitalism. Okay, so then I'm assuming you had your website at that point, cjhopkins.com.
I did not.
You did not?
That came much later. It's interesting that you make that distinction. A lot of people make the distinction. You know, I use the phrases, you know, global capitalism and, you know, mm-hmm. Globocap and what have you. And it's very interesting. I'm not an economist or, you know, a financial expert or what have you. And what I'm talking about when I use those phrases are it's not really the economic system even.
Right.
It's the imperial power structure.
Right.
That, you know, emerged victorious from the Cold War. And I always just like to make that distinction. Yeah.
Right.
So my website came much later. I think, I don't remember when I got early enough that I could get my name.
So you're doing plays and then you write your first novel.
Here's the story with my plays. I've written a lot of experimental stage texts, short plays. And I was commissioned to write a few things for other people. But there were really three big plays that I was focused on in New York. Horse Country was the first one. That's the one that we got lucky with in Edinburgh and toured all over the world. There were two more after that. And over the years, in the next one was produced in Edinburgh in 2005, and then went to New York.
Uh-huh.
And the third one was produced here in Berlin and in Atlanta, a theater in Berlin and a theater in Atlanta.
Was that the Extremist?
I have a
copy of Horse Country, but I haven't. You know, I just after I read the first book, I just ordered everything I could get. But I haven't read it yet, but it was the Extremist, the one I'm dying to read. Wait, and of course I can't find it anywhere. Wait a minute, I've got to find the name. How to Entertain the Rich.
That's one of the short plays.
Yeah.
Anyway, those three plays, they're not really a trilogy, but they kind of comprised a movement for me.
Right.
And it was, 2010, 2011, when the Extremists got produced, properly produced and got published. And then it was, 2011, 2012. And these three big plays had been, you know, produced and published. And I felt like, okay, I finished that movement in the theater. And I wasn't sure what to do next, and I didn't know what to do in the theater next. And that's when I started fishing around and beginning to write my novel.
Okay.
Which I eventually finished.
So then the next step comes into political satire, essay writing. And before we begin that, I just have to say one thing. I've spent a lifetime trying to unpack mathematically what's happening financially and economically, and then along comes somebody who doesn't have to go through that process, but they can immediately see what's going on and just take it apart like a you know, like a razor blade. And what I want to know is, how do you do it? How do you see right into everything and just take it apart? You have a remarkable ability to sort of map out and understand the human condition.
Thank you. I don't think I see into everything. As I said, I'm not an economist. I'm not a financial expert. There's, so much that I don't understand. I get lost pretty quickly when I start digging into, finance and economics. I think my focus, as a writer, as a creative writer, as well as, you know, a political satirist and a commentator, A lot of it has been on power. Yeah, just right. Really large, you know, large historical movements of power. And also, you know, interpersonal power, how power in society, you know, influences us and creates realities. I mean, you know, taking it back to the theater, this is basically what we do in the theater. You know, I always describe theater to artists that I'm working with, writers that I'm mentoring. I say, you know, the film is like a dream, like a hallucination, but theater is church.
Right.
There's a congregation, we're all there, everybody's present. And some of us get up, you know, on the stage, on the altar, dress funny, and perform this weird ritual, and the congregation kind of interprets it, you know, okay, right. What did that mean? And so, you know, it's kind of a reality generating machine.
Right.
And from that, that's also, you know, I think my focus politically is I'm really focused on ideology, and I've been watching how our ideology is created. And so naturally I have a lot of focus on propaganda and on the media, and on messaging in general.
So then you come into 2016. Now, had you created the Consent Factory yet?
I hadn't. What happened was, I had finished my novel, and I stuck my head up. You know, I'd really been a hermit, you know, for most of my life. And you know, swore that I would never ever join social media, you know, and now, you know, I'm on Twitter and Facebook half the day. But I'd been a hermit, and I stuck my head up after I finished this novel, and the 2016 campaign was going on. And, you know, being an old lefty, I got excited. You know, there's Bernie Sanders. It's, oh my gosh, it looks like there's an old populist lefty out there. You know, trying to do something. And then I was immediately, you know, engaged by how viciously and systematically the corporate media and the powers that be were setting out to derail and demonize Bernie Sanders. And that's kind of what drew me in to it. And I thought, right. I don't know, what the heck? And I wrote a little piece and I sent it into Counterpunch and they ran it. Or I wrote another one and sent it in and they ran it again. And so I was kind of off to the races, you know. Once I started that and it felt like, you know, okay, maybe this will be an interesting thing to do, then I set up the Consent Factory and things developed from there.
So your essays from 2016 to 2017, I'm right in the middle of them now. It's called Trump Apocalypse. Is that how you pronounce it? It's very funny. But I just have to quote one. I love this. There's so many. I tend to mark up books, and you get a lot of marks on your books. A lot has happened over the last 4 years, some of which happened and some of which didn't, depending on your definition of happened. Some of what happened actually happened, and some of it only officially happened of it. Happened. Some of it probably actually happened, but it didn't officially, and there's no proof that it did, so it might as well have never have happened. Some of it definitely actually happened, but it is definitely not what officially happened, so it absolutely never happened, even though we watched it happen. You go on. But you're going back and forth between this official reality and reality. And so you do that for 2016, 2017. You describe in 2016 the switch from the war on terrorism to the war on populism. So maybe if you could just give us a few words on what happened and how you described it.
Yeah, my take on it was, I was pretty focused on the whole war on terror. I was, you know, in New York. On September 11th, the whole thing roll out, watched the whole, war on terror narrative roll out, and, you know, paid attention to everything that happened during that, and satirized some of it in my columns. And it was just glaring to me. In the summer of 2016, there's an article that was in the Guardian that I think I referred to in the essays. They were literally pushing, you know, the summer of terror, you know, the summer of fear or something. There had been these various, I refer to them as non-terrorist attacks.
Right.
These lone individuals, many of whom were disturbed and, you know, decided that they wanted to become world famous or whatever it was, you know, but these so-called lone wolf terrorists who were not connected to any terror organization at all.
Right.
And anyway, it was the war on terror was in full swing. And then suddenly, Trump appeared and Trump got the nomination. And I watched, you know, just virtually the entire edifice of the corporate media just drop the war on terror, you know, like a hot stone, and switch immediately. And, you know, it was no longer the terrorists are coming to get us, but it was, you know, the resurrection of Hitler is back, and, you know, and Hitler's force. And it was... I've overused this in my columns, but it was like that moment in 1984 where they switch official enemies right in the middle of a speech.
Right.
Yeah. It was, to me, it was that abrupt.
Right.
And that's when the whole war on populism, you know, the bifurcated war on populism narrative really began. Right there, summer.
So I refer, one of my nicknames for the corporate media is the Shriek-O-Meter.
Yeah.
And I have various pictures of women shrieking and to sort of describe it, because it's so loud, it's so incoherent, it can be very, very mean, and of course, totally ridiculous. But what you describe, and I'm, you know, so the review we put up is for your book, The War on Populism. I'll just hold it up here. What you describe is the absolute incoherence and irrationality of this machinery getting worse and worse and worse throughout this period. And I don't know how you do it. It's so funny. I happened to read it during the week of the election, which was the perfect time to read it because I was laughing through the whole thing. But you found a way of making sense of the whole thing without losing your state of amusement. And I want to know how you did it.
I think it's mostly just for my own sanity. It's if I can't, you know, so much of comedy, Catherine, comes from rage, you know, and anger.
Right, right.
And I think I've always tried to channel my anger into comedy, you know, and find a way to laugh. You know, I credit my mother for this, by the way.
Did you grow up in Florida?
Yeah,
or you just went? Yeah, okay.
Grew up in Miami, okay. And I credit my mother for that. You know, she taught me, you know, how to laugh at the madness to stay sane.
Right.
And frankly, it didn't feel very hard. I mean, just the absurdity of everything that we've been subjected to for about 4 years. It was just begging to be skewered.
Now, in it, you describe the fact, because I've spent a lot of time in the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, you know, counseling white men not to take it personally that they're being attacked. But one of the things you mentioned, I can't remember if it was the ADL who attacked you or someone called you a Nazi. And here you are. You know, as far away from a far right person as could be, being attacked for something that you're not in a very extreme way. So tell us what I was very curious. I thought this is, it's funny, but it's not funny. So I know how it feels. It doesn't feel good.
It has been not funny. It has become funny. You know, I wish I had a dollar for every time I have been, you know, called a Nazi sympathizer, anti-Semite, and just everything that you can think of. I think what happened, and I forget which essays I really focus on it in, but I did focus on it. It was really interesting to me the way the propaganda was rolled out, during the last 4 years and the war on populism. Of course, the Russia stuff came first.
Right.
We got hit with, Russiagate, and, it was Russians coming out of the woodwork, and Trump is, there was the, the FSB tape, and the dossier, I forget who it was who wrote the infamous piece, where Trump had supposedly been an actual Russian intelligence asset. 1987 or something,
Right.
All the Russia stuff came out first, and I feel like the Russia stuff kind of captured all of the anti-Trump liberals that were just ready for it, and it's the Rachel Maddow crowd, and Russia. Further left, over in my territory, people really weren't going for the Russia stuff. And it was like, okay, it's ridiculous. We don't like Trump, but he's not a Russian asset. And so GlobalCap, they had an answer for that. It's like, okay, we got the liberals with the Russia stuff, and we can get the rest of the left with the Hitler stuff.
Right.
And that's when, and that's the second part of the whole war on populism propaganda, is they went really, really hard on the Hitler stuff, the fascism stuff. And most of the left territory that I, have swum in, eventually got sucked into that. And it became so divisive that anyone like me who was refusing to jump up and down and call Donald Trump Hitler, we started getting accused of being, fascist sympathizers, Trump loving, far right, shills and what have you. People like me on the fringes, but even much better known journalists, Greenwald and Matt Taibbi,
right.
Aaron Matei, Michael Tracy. I mean, these people have been attacked. As well.
So my impression was that you were shocked to find yourself in those crosshairs.
I was shocked at first. I had a big falling out with Counterpunch, who I had written continuously for a couple of years. They ran pretty much everything that I sent them, and then suddenly, I think it was 2018. And then suddenly they stopped running my pieces and stopped answering my emails. I put a post up on social media about it or something. And the next thing I knew, they were, going behind my back and talking to journalists and, insinuating that I was an anti-Semite and some stuff. and this type of business, that was shocking to me. I didn't.
Right.
Because I started sending stuff to Counterpunch originally because of Alex Coburn and, the respect that I had had for the publication.
Right.
I think that was the first big shock. But since then I have, I've just been called these things so often, over the last couple of years, I've become accustomed to it.
And so has it died down or does it just continue?
It hasn't died down. I think it has really intensified. It'll be interesting to see what happens now. But that hysteria, I think, has just intensified all the way up to the present. I'm curious as to what's going to happen in the next weeks and months, because part of the big script here after the election was, that Trump was finally going to go full Hitler, and dissolve Trumpists, and he's going to, roll out his underground army of, of Russia-loving American Nazis, and start rounding people up or something. And, we're laughing, but this is actually, if you look at some of the publications that, I used to write for,
Right.
People are actually, and even in the mainstream media, people are actually seriously, you know, writing this stuff and
right.
putting this out there and bombarding people with this type of propaganda, which of course is absolutely ridiculous.
Right. And I run into many people, including friends, who really fall into, you know, I think of this as like the 57 varieties. So if you're a Globocap, is that one of your nicknames for them?
Yeah.
If you're Globocap, you can't just have one marketing strategy. You need 57 varieties for these different groups. And so, you know, when I look at it as a marketing segmentation, it makes perfect sense. But I'm always shocked when I get into a personal friendship, and I have friends all across the spectrum, and they've really come to believe it. And, you know, when you challenge them to come up with evidence, you know, there's nothing they can do but point at Rachel Maddow or, you know, one of the shills. And of course, a lot of it, one of the worst exercises on the Shriekometer, I don't know if you ever wrote about it, I haven't found it in your work yet, I was in California during the 2014 Senate races, and the Republicans were in real danger of losing the Senate. And so they tried everything, nothing would work. And finally, I don't know, it was about 8 to 12 weeks out from the election, they decided to have an Ebola pandemic. And it was the ugliest thing I've ever seen the Shriekometer do up until that point. And it was ridiculous because even the Wall Street Journal, which normally doesn't go there as financial press, but basically within 3 days, the front page of every paper was shrieking Ebola. And it was basically, you got a black president. He's going to bring in these, you know, these germs from Africa. We're all going to die if you don't let the, you know, the Republicans keep the Senate. And I hate to say this, it worked. Yeah. It really, really did work. But in the meantime, while this is going front page in every paper that I read, San Jose Mercury News, Wall Street Journal, everything, the business newsletters are sending messages saying, oh, don't worry, this will have no effect on your business. You know, this is not a real issue. You don't have to worry about this. And literally the day after the election, it's like page 7 and then it's gone the next day. It was so on off. And, you know, and now it's all become like that. It's all this anyway. So we come up. Now, when did you leave and move to Berlin?
2004.
So you got out of the United States before the financial crisis. Good move.
I did. Okay. I had been, you know, after Horse Country did well, that's really when my plays started going international. And I'd been in Europe bouncing around for a little while. I was in Berlin. It's first time in Berlin. And it really reminded me of San Francisco before the dot-com boom. You know, the
right.
slogan was, you know, I think poor but sexy. And I you know, honestly, I had been looking for a way out of the United States for a couple of years. And so, yeah, I did it in 2004.
Well, it's very interesting because from what I can tell, the Germans seem to be in the lead. Our science editor is from Germany, or she's Austrian, but she lives in Germany. And I have a lot of friends in Germany, and Germany seems to be in the lead in the fact-based reality and promoting fact-based reality. It's almost as though the Germans got so beat up over World War II that they're absolutely courageous about insisting on a fact-based reality this time around.
Yes and no. You know, I disagree with that a bit because I have watched and been subjected to just the immense propaganda campaign that has
right.
been rolled out, you know, since the beginning of you know, the pandemic. It has been really something to watch.
Right.
The degree to which the German media is just absolutely demonizing, first marginalizing and then demonizing any, you know, form of dissent
right.
from the official narrative
yep.
to the degree that newspapers unironically are now, you know, just routinely calling anyone who deviates from the official narrative a corona denier.
Right.
Which
I hadn't heard that one yet.
Yeah. And Catherine, you can imagine the connotations, you know, that has in Germany, you know, to call anybody an anything denier.
Right.
You know, and this is, you know, the government's doing this, you know, the media is doing this. There was a German politician that I think after the big demonstrations in August, you know, was shrieking for people to be, you know, anyone who, you know, who all the corona deniers, you know, need to be deported.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And there was recently a short-lived but nonetheless really infuriating public service ad that was put out by the Berlin government, by the Senat of Berlin. I don't know if I can do this on your show on video, but I'll try it and you can edit it out if I don't.
Okay.
The advertisement, and now this is a public service advertisement that was commissioned and put out by the government of Berlin, right? And it was an older woman wearing a mask, right? Staring into the camera, doing this.
Wow.
And the message was, this is what we have for anyone who doesn't wear a mask. We follow the rules here.
Wow.
I can send you, I have it. I saved it. I can send it to you.
I'd love to have a copy of that. Wow.
I will send it to you if you remember when we're done. My life in Germany has been good. I have admired the fact-basedness up until about this year.
Right. So our work organizes around publishing 4 magazines a year. We call them wrap-ups. So we do quarterly and annual wrap-ups. And the one that's just going to the printer next week is called The Injection Fraud, and it's all on the COVID-19 pandemic. And this time, rather than really try and write about it, because I said this is a story that has a past, a present, a future, you know, and we're only in the early innings. Yeah. But I wanted to say to people, because I watch my subscribers lose so much time reading and listening to sources which are not informative or reliable or trustworthy. So the idea of this was to say, look, here's who you can trust. And here are the websites, here are the articles, you know, here's, you know, because we know the official reality is not true, but then figuring out what's true, that's a whole more complicated thing. Anyway, so the idea was to sort of put up the best of the pandemic. And of course, at the end of the second quarter, we close the, you know, we sort of close the copy. And the rule is you're not allowed to sneak in something that was published after that, except I did not discover the COVIDian cult since after that. So I broke the rule and moved it in. Because if you said to me, what is the single best commentary on the COVIDian op, or what some of us call the magic virus, your article, The COVIDian Cult Up at the Consent Factory, is absolutely genius. And it's so insightful and helpful in terms of understanding what's happening. And it does it without being deeply depressing. I don't know how you do it. Anyway, so one of my goals with this interview is I want everyone to read The COVIDian Cult. And The COVIDian Cult is featured in the best of the pandemic. I'm happy to send you a copy if you want to get it. But tell us about the thinking and the process that went into kind of inventing this incredible article. And I don't know if you notice, but the commentary all around the world on the pandemic has now switched to the COVID cult. So you have absolutely defined one of the most important, if not the most important, memes on this whole situation. It's quite remarkable. I don't know if you realize how it's reverberating. And of course, there's a group that call it the Branch COVIDians. So tell us, what was the process by which you burped out the COVIDian cult?
I tell you, the funny thing is I'm invariably wrong about which of my essays are going to catch on. And not the ones that I dearly love are the ones that usually sink like stones. And the ones that I think, I'm just going to, you know, bang this out because I have to. that's kind of the way I went into the Covidian cult piece. I've read a lot about cults. I've, you know, done a lot of research. And you know, as I said, I've focused on, you know, how our minds, you know, get controlled and how, how our perceptions of reality get formed and how, you know, interpersonal power dynamics work. I had been, you know, I have covered this, you know, COVID phenomenon, you know, almost exclusively since March. You know, when it started, you know, I think I probably had it at some point earlier, you know.
We all got this bizarre flu in February. So I'm assuming that's what it was.
Yeah, I had I teach the script writing workshops, you know, to writers. And one of my writers was Italian and she had gone to Rome. Where everybody was getting sick and she came back and was sick and then I was sick and my wife was sick. It was, you know, just this multi-week, you know, flu, which to tell you the truth is not that unusual in Berlin in the winter.
Right.
So we didn't think anything of it. And I wrote a couple of funny pieces, you know, just, you know, kind of making fun of the initial hysteria, having no idea where we were going. And then, you know, the emergency measures and so on started getting rolled out and the lockdowns and so on. And I kind of lost my sense of humor and became horrified and started documenting what was actually happening to society. And then I kind of got my sense of humor back a little bit. And long story short, I've been covering this all year long and really focusing on it. And I think when the Covidian cult piece came about, I had written about the totalitarianism, I had written about the virus, and I just wanted to focus on I think where we are, which is it's so bizarre. It's like there are two parallel realities,
right,
that are running. I'm a skeptic, you know, you're a skeptic, it sounds like. If you talk to people who are just, you know, swallowing all the, you know, propaganda that comes at them, you know, these conversations are bizarre. It's like we're in one reality and they're in a completely different reality. And it just struck me, this is exactly like talking to someone who is, you know, deeply embedded in a cult.
Right.
And who has been indoctrinated to that degree, where there's just no way to reach across and connect anymore.
You describe, I think, I don't remember if it's in the article or in another place, but you describe, you know, once upon a time, we lived in a culture of sanity and we dealt with cults. And now the global culture is a cult and we're these little islands of sanity.
It really has. I think that was, you know, the main realization, you know, the main point of clarity that I had that I wanted to get across in that piece, because it normally it is that way. Normally, you know,
right.
If you speak to someone who is in a cult, they're the minority. And you know, we're the normal ones,
right?
What they're saying sounds crazy, and it has literally inverted. It's literally flipped to the point where, you know, we're now, I'm the one that sounds crazy because I don't believe, you know, we need to turn, you know, the entire world into a, you know, totalitarian, you know, pathologized totalitarian, you know, nightmare because of, you know, a virus which is not that exceptional in the history of human viruses, you know?
So I never feel crazy or think I'm crazy because I'm watching the financial transactions. And the financial transactions don't lie. And so when one group is shutting another group down and taking away their assets and their business, I'm just watching the financial patterns which tell me what's going on, and they don't lie.
It's,
so
Absolutely. I think the thing that prompted that piece, and it's something that I focus on a lot, it's less of, really less about facts, but more about the experience,
right,
of being surrounded by people who have suddenly adopted a rather extreme ideology,
right.
A rather extreme ideology where we all need to just kind of mindlessly follow orders, you know, and, you know, wear our masks so that everyone can see that we're, you know, obeying the rules and, you know, and perform all of these bizarre and absurd compliance rituals.
Right.
You know, there was a very formative experience when I was a young man. I wasn't a kid. I was in my early 20s. One of my girlfriends, her mother was a devotee or whatever, of some sort of guru. I forget what he was. It was like an Indian guru, and they had their cult. And the mother, you know, said to my girlfriend, "Oh, come to this big, you know, cult, this big gathering, spiritual gathering that we're having." And then she dragged me along. And I went into this room, thousands of people in this auditorium, you know, in downtown Miami. And you could feel the physical power of all of these people, yeah, who absolutely believed that this little guy on stage was God. And
right.
And of course, I knew he wasn't God. My girlfriend knew he wasn't God. But the sheer physical power of it.
Right. Yeah,
it's not about belief or about knowing things. It's the power of being surrounded by thousands of human beings that absolutely believe this thing.
Right. It's the field.
Exactly. And you're right. you're just, you know, an individual or a couple of individuals in the middle of that energy field. It's kind of the way that I feel when I go grocery shopping now.
Right.
This dynamic, it fascinates me and it frightens me, and I've been writing about it all my life. I feel like this year I have watched society rapidly
go mad,
really rapidly. I've watched society transform from what it was, you know, back in November, December last year, into this bizarre, pathologized, totalitarian society. And by not going along with it, right, I have become an absolute outsider and a target.
Not on the Solari Report. You're going to be an insider. Because in fact, the biggest question, complaint, concern we get from our subscribers, who are all over, mostly Northern Hemisphere, so mostly North America, but plenty in Europe too, is... You know, these are people who just don't go mad with the crowd. They just have the ability to maintain their own field outside the field, is the way I would describe it. But they're having the same experience you're describing, and they're saying, what do I do? How do I navigate a society that's lost its mind? And how do I find other people like me who haven't lost their mind? You know, how do I do this? And, as soon as I published the review, one of my favorite subscribers went out and got a copy, and he just posted. He says, "I can't stop laughing," because I think to do it, you have to stay in a state of amusement.
I try. I think that's part of it. I mean, that's a large part of what my work is, and I try to do that. Also, I think part of it is acknowledging, you know, what's happening. It's part
right.
of why I wrote the piece, and acknowledging it for me, it has been important to realize, you know, when I go outside, you know, when I go outside, I have to kind of prepare myself, because there's
right.
going to be, you know, a little block of art standing on the corner, you know, telling me to put my mask on because I have to cross the street through an outdoor market to get to the canal that I like to take a walk around. And, you know, when I go into the grocery store, I'm going to be surrounded by masked people who are staring at me with, you know.
Are you allowed to have a medical exemption?
No, not in Germany.
No.
You can, but you have to go to the doctor, and the doctor has to write something, write up a, you know, a certification, and, you know, it's Germany, and there has to be right. paper, and it has to be stamped. You know?
Right. So a lot of my Swiss subscribers have medical exemptions.
Yeah.
That's how they do it. Right.
Yeah. They're not in Germany, really.
Okay. So now we've had the election. We haven't had the state certification, so it's not completely over. But you've just written a new piece. And tell us a little bit about where you are right now in this new piece.
The new piece was kind of picking up on all of the stuff that's in the books and all of the essays that I've been writing over the last 4 years. I've been saying it, over and over again. I've been saying, you know, there's just no way that GloboCap is going to let this guy serve a second term. It's
right.
It's just not going to happen. As I said, you know, I'm not a Donald Trump supporter, but I'm kind of a Donald Trump supporter. what I mean by that is, you know, I'm basically a people supporter. I'm a populist, you know, is what it comes down to. I'd like to see people have a lot more power over shaping their government and their society. And even though I might disagree with a lot of the you know, views or policies of people that are on, you know, people on the right, I understand the anger and the backlash against, you know, against what has been happening to the United States. Yeah, I don't think that that neo-nationalism has a future, but I understand the sentiment. People, it's like, wait a minute, you know, we're supposed to be living in a sovereign country.
Right.
You know, we're supposed to, you know, be Americans, and you know, politicians are supposed to be taking care of America. You know, I understand these people, and I appreciate that resistance. I think Trump has become a figurehead, you know, and he became a symbol for this populist resistance, you know,
right.
on the right. And there's just no way that, you know, the global capitalist establishment was going to allow him to continue in office and to continue to be a symbol.
Although you have to admit, he got done for them some of the most, if you look at the different sort of governmental things they wanted to accomplish, he's gotten done a lot of the big things that I don't think a Democrat could have gotten done during this period.
And again, that doesn't surprise me.
Right.
You know, I have time to get into the actual, you know, machinery of how Washington works, and, you know, what kind of power the president actually has, and so
right.
on. And, you know, Donald Trump is Donald Trump. He's still Donald Trump. He's, you know, the same Donald Trump that he's been all of his life. You know, none of that surprises me. I think the canvas that I'm looking at, Catherine, is less about the man himself,
right.
policies and the government, and it's more about the symbolic or ideological struggle. You know,
And the thing I most enjoyed about Donald Trump, because I was from New York, so getting over the shock of the idea that anybody might vote for Donald Trump. You know, I came out of New York just loathing Donald Trump.
Sure.
And I had, when I was on Wall Street, our PR firm also did Trump. And so I had a little insight into Trump. So I was in shock, you know, but I came around actually during the campaign and voted for him. And, you know, it was Michael Moore who persuaded me to do that. And you pick up on that in your book, because you said, you know, because my feeling was, if you have, and I'll speak as an investment banker, if you have a negative return on investment system and it's destroying value, I call it the tapeworm, you know, if you can't fix it, just break it. So it'll stop. It'll stop destroying value. So the theory on, you know, we didn't have high hopes that it could be reformed, but we figured, okay, could break, you know, maybe he could break it. But what the thing he did that I most appreciate, I think all solutions require transparency. And he did a lot to make a fool out of the Shriekometer. And he tore cracks in the fabric of reality. Leonard Cohen says, you know, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets through. And he would tear, you know, he would tear a crack and then some light would get through. And to me, it completely opened the conversation, which I appreciated. So now let's talk about your future. What's next for CJ Hopkins?
Can I jump in for 1 second?
Oh, please. Yes.
You just perfectly described, you know, why I've been doing what I've been doing for the last 4 years. Is that that is exactly the Donald Trump phenomenon. What happened is the American, a lot of the American people had had enough of the simulation and threw a big rock through the window. And for the last 4 years, I feel like we've been able to look through the window and actually people could actually look and see, you know, what things are, you know, and I
right.
thought you just described it perfectly. And it's why I've been writing. It's why those two books are there. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right. And I think that's one of the things that the, you know, global cap elite is afraid of, and that's why they've started the cult.
Well, this is what I mean by the war on populism is
right.
They need to replace this window, you know, close this back up, you know, shut this, you know, this populist backlash down.
Right.
It was much easier for them to do it with on the left with people like Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn in the UK. You know, there is some.
Oh, did they work him over? That was one of the worst I've ever seen.
You're talking about Corbyn.
Yeah,
they did him proper, as they would say
right.
in the UK.
Right.
I wrote a number of pieces about it. And it's been harder to do in the US because most of the populist rebellion has been coming from the right, and there's a broad base there.
Right.
But absolutely, I think this is exactly what the last 4 years have been about. It's been about Globocap, you know, trying to shut down this populist rebellion.
Right. And in your new piece, you point out their goal is divide and conquer. Is the civil war, starting the civil war.
I'm curious. I'm curious to see what will happen.
Right.
And I don't know right now. The script, you know, the script has been, you know, that Trump is Hitler. And he's going to, you know, roll out the, you know, the Putin Nazis are going to roll out, you know, the Russia loving militias, you know, the Proud Boys or whoever, you know, are going to, you know, take over the streets of America and, you know, establish the Trumpian dictatorship or some. This has been the script for 4 years. And
right.
this is the ultimate moment. It's the last moment. The way the script is supposed to go is Trump is supposed to refuse to leave office, and then he's going to attempt some sort of military coup, you know, and then of course roll out all of his, you know, underground Putin Nazis also, and then the forces of goodness are going to have to, you know, put down this coup and drag him out of office, you know, and save Western democracy and the world. I'm very curious, and I'm kind of anxious to see what will happen from so far, at least, you know, and somewhat unsurprisingly, you know, there hasn't been, you know, widespread rioting, you know, from Trump supporters.
Well, I think Trump supporters understand the risks you're describing.
Yeah.
And my expectation is what the global capitalists are going to do next is try and finish destroying mainstream. Mm-hmm. So you're going to use COVID-19 to destroy all income producing. Because the base of populism is a small business, a small farm, a proprietor, a church that can generate their own income. And so it's economic independence that's the real base of populism. And that's what they're going to attack next. They're
going
to, now they've done tremendous harm, and we haven't seen all of it because the, you know, the municipalities have lost, they're up to about $500 billion of combined deficits. So they're going to have to cut. That's got to roll through. And one of the things you're seeing with it, a lot of these crazy cult things like the masks is those fines are an opportunity for those municipalities who are struggling to fund their budgets to charge more. You know, it's kind of like another taxation opportunity.
Sure.
So here's what I want you to do. Walk us through your websites, how we sign up for your email, how we sign up for your Patreon, because my subscribers need to stay in cahoots with you.
Great. It's pretty easy to do. They just need to go to consentfactory.org. All right. And right there on the front page, just over to the right, I think, there's a little gizmo where you can sign up to get my monthly newsletter, which is strictly monthly, you know, no spam. And sometimes I even forget to send it out for a month. So there's the newsletter. And then just below that, there are other little links. If generous souls want to support what I'm doing, there's a Patreon link, there's a PayPal link, and it's right there on the main page of the Consent Factory, consentfactory.com.
And we can get your books. You've got the two books of essays. You've got Horse Country's available. The Extremists is available. Anything else available?
And the plays, my other play is Screw Machine Eye Candy, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Big Bob. And this is a rather savage play that also won, a writing award in Edinburgh after creating a bit of controversy. It's rather savage, but that's also published. People can buy that. And my novel, Zone 23.
Right. I have Zone 23. I haven't read it yet, but I've got it.
So they're all for sale. Pretty much it, you can order them from pretty much any bookstore, Amazon. And there's a page right there on the Consent Factory where all the books are.
So when they go to the Consent Factory, one of the things they have to do is you must click on the link that says clients.
Don't tell them. Yeah.
So just describe what happens when the Consent Factory is presented as it's like a little think tank that helps people rule the world, right?
It's
manufacture consent.
That's right. Manufacturing consent for over 250 years. actually manufacturing consent for private and government clients for 250 years. Yeah, the Consent Factory is I describe it as a shady half think tank, half consulting operation that probably has its nasty little fingers into everything.
Right. And so then you click on clients and the picture is priceless. you just have to go and look at it. So I can't make CJ describe it to you, but...
Don't tell them. Make them click.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell your new audience before we close?
Not that I can think of. I mean, just other than, I'm grateful to have you. It's funny. It's one of the things that I get, demonized for is, not writing for, a specific little audience. That is all, ideologically, homogenous and so on. I'm glad to reach out to different audiences, and I'm grateful to be able to reach out to yours.
Well, it's very important, that we grow our islands of sanity and connect. I will tell you this, because I'm always hopeful. I went to Washington to work in the Bush administration in 1989. And after I left the Bush administration, I started an investment bank. And we had a rule that we would never have more than 50 employees so that we would avoid certain types of regulation. And so everybody else was sort of a contractor, or we'd hire companies. And one day we got all 50 together, and the politics were getting as bizarre as they were then, because that was the start of globalization. And so I asked everybody to say whether they were a Democrat or Republican. And what I discovered is 24 had come to Washington as Democrats, 26 had come as Republicans, and all 50 described themselves as independent or other. So I think your audience is independent and other.
I think you hit it right on the head.
Yeah. Right.
And it always has been.
Okay. Well, CJ Hopkins, we're very excited to discover your work. And we look forward to being in cahoots. If there's anything I or the Salieri Report can do to support you, you know, tell us what we can do. Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. You have a wonderful day.
Do the same.